everybody, and welcome back to You Can't Win. This is Tom here, and I'm joined by Don as usual. Today, we're going to be doing something that we normally do on our premium episodes that you get by subscribing to the Patreon. We're going to talk about a book or two and kind of dig into that a little bit. So today, Donald is going to be sharing with us two books by Jacques Maritain, and they are about Christianity and democracy and things like that. So why don't you introduce these things to us, Donald?
So it's the volume itself is like a sort of thin volume. It's only 140 pages, and it includes two essays, Christianity and Democracy, and The Rights of Man and the Natural Law. And it's kind of an interesting volume in itself because it's put out by Ignatius Press, which is a Catholic imprint. And the book itself is like the wrapping of it. Everything on it is very, very far right. Not far right, but like right wing kind of stuff. Like the back, like the background for it, you know, tries to make him into a proto-Reaganite kind of thing that anticipated the wars, like the Cold War against communism. And the texts in it date from the early 1940s. And it's at that moment, it's at that key moment, really, where they know that they're probably going to beat Hitler. And they're starting to do the post-war order planning and stuff, right? So in 1942, 43 and stuff, right? So Jacques Maritain is a philosopher who is a faithful Catholic. And so his whole impulse is to look at democracy as something inspired by the gospel. Like it's not, which is contrary to a lot of Catholic thought before that, which tended to be hostile towards any sort of liberalism, right? So I think it's interesting because it's kind of like, if you look at it as like a, you know, the whole post-war order as like these big tectonic plates that are trying to get along kind of thing, like the communist movement worldwide, Soviet Union and all that, the Catholic Church is still there as a giant presence, even though, you know, the war has taken its toll on it. And, you know, you've got the workers movement around the world and these decolonial movements. The United States is rising to the, you know, the heights of power, whatever kind of thing. So I think it's interesting because even in his short essays, he connects all those different things together and shows how a Catholic response can take each of them seriously kind of thing, right? So he doesn't put it in quite this way, but it's that he doesn't have like a, he's not a communist, he's anti-communist, but he really, really goes, digs into the way that communism responds to something that people want kind of thing, right? So everything that, like anything that he disagrees with, he's kind of, he's very, very charitable towards parts of it kind of thing, right? So I think that's really interesting because there is sort of this resurgence across the world, right, of Christianity sort of distancing itself from democracy in different ways, right? Even though it's winning victories different places, like, you know, evangelicals are or whatever, like in the States with Trump, evangelicals have kind of lined up behind him. Bolsonaro in Brazil, you know, stuff like that, right? So, or like, say, the Catholics in France, a lot of them, you know, a lot of the rank and file back things like the National Rally or National Front. So, you know, that's kind of a, it's, you know, it's, I think it's still relevant. And especially on the left, again, you have this skepticism towards human rights. And he was a very prominent proponent of human rights from a Christian perspective, which tended to be argued for in very secular terms, obviously, so before that. So I thought it was an interesting book because he doesn't take simple answer. Like, it's very, very straightforward, but he doesn't really cheat in certain ways kind of thing, right? Like, he looks at the way that the state works, and he doesn't have this traditional model that the state should just promote Catholicism outright, like pay priests and all that kind of stuff or whatever, you know? So that's interesting even for just a person of that time. It's like he is in himself like catching up to what's happened across Europe over the last two centuries or so, you know? So I think that's kind of a interesting starting point for, you know, that whole thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, that is cool. What sort of responses does he have to things like communism or the labor movement and stuff like that?
So his whole thing is he talks about like a democratic impulse and the evangelical impulse. And it's this idea that fraternity and social justice and other things like that are real, real demands that people have. And they see in communism a solution for that, especially if the church is being corrupt or other things like that. And he's saying that if Christians had led those movements in a way that it would have been better for the world, but they didn't. So there was certain costs associated with that kind of thing is basically the, and he kind of sees it as a, he says a lot of things that I think that would outrage or anger people who are on the left, but I think that they're not really as simplistic as the sort of proto Reaganite model would, you know, make them look or something like that. So, you know, he's saying that, you know, he would call like the gospel message or something, the Christian message, a call to, you know, love your neighbor and all of that, you know, sort of traditional Christian morality as being real, the real basis of truth for these movements that then kind of, he sees communism as sort of like the accumulation of all of the errors of those movements into that kind of thing. So, and then from the other side, he sees fascism as sort of a total rejection of the good in that has evolved over time. So it's, the whole thing is like a rally against fascism as a thing, but it's interesting in the way that he articulates a post-war order where these things could kind of cooperate in different ways. Like he says that the communists have earned a right to help participate in creating a post-war order because of the sacrifices of the people and all that kind of thing. So, which is interesting because standard sort of right-wing response would be almost, you know, they're godless heathens that are trying to take over the world and all that kind of thing. So he has much more of a deep respect for people. The thing I think is interesting too is that he keeps on board with a lot of traditional Christian sort of thinking about the state. So he does have, which is something that I've always, I mean, or at least recently sort of thinking more about, where he's saying that, like, you know, kingship, monarchy, and things like that are not necessarily evil. Like they're not, it's not that they're evil. It's that, you know, it's more like fit and things like that. It's more like the, we didn't have the capacity in the past, but he does take a step further and say that the gospel message of fraternity does inspire democratic movements and make them appropriate for our age or something. So I think that's interesting because it's like a, it's not like a pluralism about diversity and truth. It's just about respect kind of thing, right? So it's like, he's not saying that secular people, whatever, deserve pluralism because they might be right. He's saying, I'm right, but you deserve to be on equal footing in the state because of dignity of the person kind of thing or something like that. So instead of, I don't know, I think that's kind of interesting because, you know, it's something we don't hear about as much these days in a progressive context, right? Like the idea of a state being informed by religious ideas is almost wholly seen as like a far right thing or maybe a, you know, something foreign to the Western world, at least, you know? So,
yeah, I think there's like a fundamental idea that if you're going to have some sort of religious character to a state, the utility of that is those right-wing authoritarian kind of,
yeah,
you know, behaviors that you can enact through that, and that there wouldn't be any reason to have something that looks anything like a secular pluralistic sort of thing if the state is religious. The only reason would be to circumvent those.
Sure.
It's kind of like, you know, we almost take that stuff for granted in the West. So it's like, why would you want that if you aren't just trying to get around that in the first place?
And so his whole sort of take on that is that the state should actually be relatively neutral towards a lot of these different goods when it comes to, you know, it should promote freedom of speech and all these other things. And the reason, part of the reason why is because of that dignity of the person and treating people with respect and equality, rather than saying that they're somehow, you know, like it's built into, like he's saying that is a strategy for promoting the gospel in his mind kind of thing, right? So he's saying that by creating these sort of secular rules, I mean, secular in the sense that sort of neutral between religion, but they would still be informed by Christianity directly in some respects, because he's saying that that's a way to show people respect such that they would eventually come around to, you know, it's like, if instead of trying to make the state indoctrinate people, then promote social justice, and then that will be promoting the Christian message in itself kind of thing, which I think is kind of interesting. And I think that the way he frames it is interesting too, where he's got like a high values and low values, I would call them, like where he's got this, like, he's sort of like rock solid on things about the basics of the religion, right? Like how, you know, the existence of God and all those kind of things are just like rock solid. But then he says that like the way that we operate in politics is really, really like risky and up to chance and our perspective, and it's hard to do. And we kind of have to go along with things that other people have already organized for us and all that. So he's kind of saying that the sort of, I would call them like low values, like of trying to negotiate these different things in society. He's saying that's like a messy, messy process, but it's always informed in some indirect way by, or directly by, the religious message kind of thing. Like, so it's, but it's much more dimly, much more, you know, like a, it's almost like a afterthought of the original message. So that's interesting too, because I think a lot of people, when they look for like a theistic interpretation of politics, they don't make that distinction at all, right? Like, it's almost like there's a direct correlation between anything that religion says and anything you should do in politics, right?
Yeah.
And the interesting thing in that, I think, in the Christian context, is that you get people either like fascist or liberation theology or whatever, where they're very, very quick to make that step from high values to low values. And he's kind of saying one of the reasons why we should have human rights and all these things is to listen to people as they, like, listen to the impulse that's around us for these, you know, fraternity and respect, you know, build that into our message and not try to go too quickly down that road towards, you know, making a sort of a clumsy state where, like, say, the church has a direct role in affairs kind of thing. So I think that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. That seems pretty good. I mean, a lot of that seems pretty familiar to me in terms of, I've seen similar things discussed by some Islamic thinkers and stuff. I'm thinking of people like Allama Iqbal, who was a Pakistani poet, and he's actually like the national poet, so he's highly revered there. And he wrote a book called The Reconstruction of Islamic Thought that doesn't directly deal with exactly the issues of like Islam and democracy or something like that. Although I think he's actually written a book that might be called that, but it deals very broadly with all kinds of things. So like, what was at the time modern science? I think this was written in the 40s or thereabouts as well. And different things like that. It was really an interesting read. There was an Egyptian in the 20s, I believe, who was called Muhammad Ali, not like the boxer, but not related to the boxer or anything. And he was much more towards the, like, if there's some kind of spectrum between Islamist and just like a complete stock liberal with a veneer of Islam, he was much more closer to the liberal kind of end of that spectrum. But still, like, he was a very interesting person that he was active in a lot of debates and stuff. So his arguments were, I don't agree with a lot of them, but he definitely was like a competent, you know, thinker and stuff, dealing with issues that a lot of other people were. I mean, we're talking about the 20s, right? So that's pretty early on in terms of this whole timeline. So yeah, I find a lot of that pretty agreeable and familiar in different ways. What do you think about his ideas around, you know, when you were describing his take on communism and how that is like you said something about like it's an accumulation of the errors or something like that, but it basically like a good intentions kind of a thing?
Yeah, so, I mean, the Catholic Church traditionally obviously was very hostile towards the French Revolution because the French Revolution was hostile towards them. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's something that people miss somehow. I did for a long time, is how there is that direct line in the minds of someone like Stalin. They see themselves as being a straight line from the French Revolution to what they're doing kind of thing, right? Like, to think of themselves as Jacobins. I mean, now obviously there's the magazine Jacobin that makes that explicit, but there's, you know, someone like Stalin thought of himself as being, you know, a rational person, bringing sort of enlightenment values to the world and, you know, making society more scientific and sweeping away all these old church institutions and all that. Like, that, at least in theory, that was the, you know, the line between it. And so he says that, Mary Tan says that the problem with the French Revolution and these different things is that they took things like fraternity and, you know, different like impulses of freedom and that, and it just got twisted here and there, different ways. you know, they made associations that were not necessarily true, or at least that the church fed into in their own ways, right? Like, so they made an identification between irrationality and the existing church, right? And so for him, what he's saying is that because they did that, they didn't realize that the impulses that they were being driven by, not including, you know, the more sociological, like broadly, you know, causes, but the impulses were, you know, things rooted in the gospel for him, like in terms of respect and all of that, and fidelity to truth and all of these things. But so he's saying that because that division happened, because the sort of rift between Christianity and sort of like rational, radical, liberal thought became autonomous from Christianity, and then sort of he's saying that like the errors that communism comes up with are basically stripping away all the rest of the aspects of Christianity from it, basically. So he's saying that that's like the logical outcome of that, is that you get a state that, you know, it still maybe says that it's inspired by fraternity, but just at every step has abandoned most of that. So he actually says in it explicitly that, you know, there's has to be a fight against the domination of money and all of these things. And he talks a bit about it, about sort of like an alternative economic system. You know, he has like a few ideas in it about associations of workers. And I mean, if you're a Marxist, you would see something like a free association of workers and think, okay, well, but he's saying it much more. It's almost like, I would say it like almost like a market socialist kind of thing or something. That's the kind of way that you would look at it. But it's funny because, you know, he says that that would be the ideal outcome of sort of like a new movement. He says that he doesn't want like the state planning that's comprehensive and all of that, right? Because he thinks that that's a, you know, an excess of rationalism and all that. But I think it's interesting that, you know, it's because the thing that it became, this Christian democracy, obviously it's not all from him, but it's like this, you know, he crystallized sort of, or like perfectly exemplifies in some ways the zeitgeist of this, right? Like conservative movements looking around for new ideology to resist, you know, to abandon fascism mostly, but then to figure out a reason why they were against communism and accepting of democracy and all these things, right? So,
right.
You know, you got the CDU in Germany, which, you know, played a very large role, obviously, for most of the post-war period. And in Italy, the Christian democracy sort of became the main rival for a long time to, you know, the communist movement. And, you know, you have analogs in France. And so, I mean, it's interesting that that became really quickly, you know, a substitute ideology for the sort of traditional right. I think it's interesting too, because the left-wing views of this tend to just see Christian democracy as a front for continuation of fascism under American control, right? So that's a very dominant view on the left in a lot of places, where they see something like the CDU as banning the Communist Party, and they see them working with the United States to station missiles and all that kind of stuff. So, and obviously over time it did come pretty close to that. Like, you know, you had someone like Reagan who did have, you know, very, very close ties between Christianity and democracy and that, and all his rhetoric and things, right? So I don't know. I think that that's it's hard to reckon with, because it's one of those things where you can look through Mary Tan's writings and go, oh, you know, well, he's talking about like a free association of workers and the importance of fraternity and the importance of the workers' movement and getting rid of the domination of money. But then you're also like, but if it can be used in this way, then that's not necessarily, you know, because the book itself that I got, like, has a foreword by someone that basically just goes, you know, Mary Tan taught us about, like, you know, basically the way to fight communism, and to nowadays we have to keep fighting for the pro-life movement or something like that kind of thing, right? So it's like, it can be abstracted so much from the thing. And it's funny because a lot of what he's saying in the book is along these lines. Like, he's talking about a lot about ideas being distorted or confused by people, you know, and he's saying that's like a constant thing that happens, but we have to aspire towards a state in which our high values and low values are sort of in concert. So yeah.
Yeah, I kind of agree with some of what is going on there, that the idea of communism being not, or just like that whole tradition from the French Revolution and the Jacobins and all that kind of stuff. Like I think when you're on the left, or when you're highly sympathetic to those, to that historical movement, you sort of see the move to secularism and the particular form of universalism that developed it through that movement. You kind of see it as distilling the good parts of what came before, right? So like,
yeah,
what Martin is arguing came from the Christian tradition. I think if you're like 100% with the kind of Jacobin / socialist movement, you're seeing that as like, well, we're taking those good aspects and leaving the kind of like rotted old aspects that we don't need or never needed. I tend to think that that's not workable, or that's, you can't really just do that, or maybe that's just not being done here exactly. So I kind of agree with the critique that's being presented there. Like I think, because especially when you move outside of the Western context and you start to look at this in different places, if these are values that are distilled from like a pre-modern Christian tradition, then why should they be applicable elsewhere? And, you know, and that clearly is the point that's being, you know, that they would argue, right? That like, these are universal globally. It's not just particular to the West. It's not just like, well, let's just upgrade Christianity to make it this secularist thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not against the idea of a secular state and all that kind of stuff, or socialist economics or anything like that. But I do think that there is something to the argument that holistic ideology and worldview that includes not just these kind of like, to categorize things in this narrow way of economics and politics and all that kind of stuff, that it works when it's all tied together and unified around a single kind of moral push of some kind, like a you know, it needs to be a unified movement that doesn't just include achieving certain political goals, economic goals, and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I understand that that's even, I think a lot of people on the left understand that, and that they do push for that. Like, I think they try to make the left be that kind of a movement. But, you know, I don't think you can do that without God, or without like a God concept of some kind.
Yeah.
I think that's where you get, like, you clearly see that in communism, like in Soviet communism or whatever, or I guess Mao too, where there's this very rigid teleology of the kind of like stages of development, and this idea of like we're on the vanguard of history and we're pushing things forward and all that kind of stuff. And that's where things fall apart for me completely, because that just seems just pulled out of a hat, you know, just to kind of make things work in that way, to make it this unified type of thing.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting, right? Because like you're pointing out the way that the CDU and all this developed over time, and there's clearly flaws there. It didn't play out the way that you would like to see it if you kind of just go by the text. But if we're playing this game of like communism versus this Christian democracy thing, I think that neither side looks very good when you kind of look at it from that perspective, right? Like, I don't think the socialist states worked out especially well if you compare it to what was being argued in the text either. So
yeah. At the same time, it made me think, though, at the same time, that like, if you have this sense of where Germany was at in 1945, and where, you know, and where Italy was at in 1945, the fact that a Christian, so the standard leftist response to that about West Germany, and to some extent Italy, is just basically, I mean, especially West Germany, is that, well, the reason why there was continuity there was because there was real continuity, because they kept Nazi judges in place, they kept Nazi police in place a lot of places, you know, like,
right,
they a lot of the system was involved people that were supposed to be denazified in different ways, but just weren't. And
there's
then
maybe
the Nazis,
some, yeah, sorry, yeah, there's maybe some merit to that,
yeah,
but that also sort of is, it kind of dismisses the idea of like there are people that just do their job and aren't 100% politically motivated by, you know what I mean? Like that, that's probably the case for many people. Anyway, sorry, go on. I interrupted you.
No, but it's, yeah, I mean, that's the flip side of it though, is that, yeah, you look at what came afterwards and I mean, really you can't say that there, you can say that there might be inflections, you know, like influences from the Nazi state, but it's almost astonishing how little there was in retrospect, right? Like the fact that it did have the level of freedom that it did, really, across the board in a lot of ways. The fact that it did build an economy that still one of the ones that's, you know, it built itself up into something. I don't know. It's like if you look at it going from Nazism to sort of like a generic European state kind of thing, right? That it's interesting that way. Like to, I mean, it's obviously under sort of the American aegis or whatever, like the, that was a, you know, it was promoted that way. But I think that it's interesting that the sort of basic coalition that undergirded it in different places where they tried to build this sort of broadly, you know, centrist kind of thing of Christian democracy plus socialist movements fighting from the edges and stuff. I don't know, like plus pile for communist parties in France and Italy and Spain and stuff. Like, I don't know. I just think it's interesting how that mix produced something that wasn't like, you know, it didn't produce another war immediately or whatever. Right. So, mm-hmm.
Suppose if you look at it, World War One, then World War II very quickly afterwards, and then that did actually stop. So,
to some extent, yeah. I mean, it became a decolonial war in a lot of ways, but then the decolonial stuff actually ended up winning a lot of them. So, yeah.
Yeah, what does he say about the decolonial movements?
So, I didn't really notice much about that. I mean, I think that his angle on that is more aimed at the internationalism aspect. Like, he's pushing the idea of, so he's talks about like the state in different like ranks kind of thing, like what's above the state and what's below the state. And above the state, like the highest level is like a religion and religious institutions. Say if you were like saying about loyalties or something, you would have more loyalty to your religion than the state kind of thing, which is an explicit like rejection of fascism, obviously. But like, it's interesting. He puts internationalism above the state too. So he's saying this like, this general idea, and not just the idea of it, but also the institutions of it. So he's talking about the United Nations, like the, just, you know, the very, very early allied forces, United Nations, like he sees that as the basis for a new potential order. So he was influential on and helped with the UN Declaration of Human Rights. So this is a lot of it is like precursor to that kind of thing, like his views on this, on global human rights and stuff. So I think that's an interesting thing because it has become sort of like the dominant NGO view, right? Like of human rights is just talked about as if it's a totally positive thing always. Obviously the Catholic Church for many years was the opposite on that kind of thing. Like it didn't see human rights as that important. But so someone like Mary Tan actually did promote this idea. He called it like personalism, of like personal individual rights. And that was very, very influential on Pope John Paul II and sort of like the way that the church evolved towards being more of a defender of democracy and stuff. So, yeah. I don't know.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose one thing that sort of gets lost sometimes in the thinking around this time period is like the development of the UN and the fact that it kind of was successful to an extent, right? Like it became a standing institution of significance in the world, and that, yeah, I don't know, that didn't exist before, really. You had the what was it called, the Vienna thing, the balance of power around
League of Nations.
Well, there was that, the precursor to the Council of Vienna. Anyway, I'm blanking on that at the moment, but that was essentially just like the major European powers, and it, you know, it expanded not only all nations in the world, but also it's like this whole idea of internationalism in like an institutionalized way. And yes, it's definitely an imperfect institution, but it exists, and it's like a real thing. It's not just sort of like vague promises and stuff at this point. So
I mean, it did end up playing a very negative role in terms of like those institutions over, you know, under neoliberalism and things. But I don't know. I do think that there's something hopeful there. I find the idea of like a global government itself like horrifying. Like I could never really even
the new world order.
Yeah. Oh, I can't handle that because I don't know. I just think of it like I think of actual politicians that would be influential on that kind of thing. And
oh yeah,
I just imagine who they would be, and I'm like, I don't want them anywhere near a global government. But
I think that's exactly the way like those Alex Jones types think about it too. To be honest, like I don't think it extends far beyond that, and that's like a fair point.
Yeah. No, I think it's true, and I don't want anything to do with that. And but I do think that like very very strong cooperation is good. Like, you know what I mean? Very like having large international institutions that are sort of the product of like custom or something is okay, I think. I don't know. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's sort of what I would like to see. Like if whenever I don't think about this too often, but whenever I do think about things like what would a modern day caliphate look like, I sort of think of something along those lines where it's almost like this loose federal system or even something along the lines of a UN thing where it recognizes different polities and it doesn't even need to be nation states. Like I think you really need to get away from that at this point. That hasn't been working in the Muslim world really at all. So it's not even like the West where it's like people are already critiquing it there, where that particular form developed in its, that was like its home culture, you know, and it kind of like is shaped and adapted to that, you know, that local culture. That's not the case in like the Middle East or South Asia or whatever. So there's no reason to stick to that particular form. So, but you could still have something that is like a federal kind of system where leaders of different places or whatever can make somewhat, you know, they can make decisions that affect like the whole area or that whole block, I guess you could call it. Yeah. So I mean, even something like the Soviet thing, obviously that's also very imperfect and it was dominated largely by like Russians and stuff like that, but you don't want that. But so, you know, something even along the lines of like a Soviet style, the Soviet Union style thing where you have these different republics and all that kind of thing like that, you know, I don't know. Yeah. I think that would be interesting to see. I'm sure that would have its flaws for sure, but it'd be cool.
Do you think that there can be some sort of compatibility between like human rights doctrine and sort of like Islamic governance, or is there?
Oh yeah. Yes. Yeah. I don't think there's really a lot of problems with that. In fact, I've seen several scholars argue and argue well, not in a cheesy kind of way. I've seen them argue quite well that the earliest places that you can like documents and debates around the idea of universal human rights were in an Islamic context. And I can't think of exactly what the years and stuff were, but it's extremely early on, like maybe 800s or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously not exactly the same thing as like the very sophisticated idea of like human rights that we have today, but just the idea that people have specific rights to things because of their humanity definitely existed in Sharia. And I don't think there's like a real issue or like conflict between that idea. Now I don't think that necessarily that is, you know, there's critiques of human rights as a regime of thinking and that kind of stuff. And I think that's, some of those things make sense and should be kind of dealt with or whatever. Like that, it's not necessarily, I'm not just saying, yeah, let's just import the present standing human rights into and call it like, yeah, let's have Sharia adopt that or whatever. One thing I've been sort of interested in lately, there's a scholar, Jonathan Brown, who he is Muslim. He's a convert as well. He's recently written a book called Slavery in Islam. And well, I mean, it's about exactly that topic. And I've been listening to a lot of his lectures that he's been giving about it. And it's kind of interesting. It's not exactly a defense of the institution of slavery or anything, but it's sort of trying to look at it from outside of like the highly charged perspective that you get. Like, he's American, right? So he you know, an American considering slavery.
Yeah.
We kind of automatically jump to it's the worst possible evil and there's no justification for it whatsoever and all that kind of stuff. And he's not even arguing against that, but he is trying to historicize it a little bit so that people can understand that slavery in different places and times did not resemble slavery in North America. You know, that American slavery and even I think Brazilian slavery is, some people have said that's even, was even worse somehow. It's hard to imagine, but worse than American slavery.
Yeah.
That was particularly bad, and that there is a lot of elements to it that if you look at it in different places, you can kind of see why that would stand for so long and why it wouldn't be seen as such like a horrendous thing. And that the abolition movement really came about not because of some kind of moral awakening, but rather because of technological and economic changes in Western society that kind of made it possible for wage labor to develop. And, you know, I'm assuming that you're kind of on board with that idea that I think is a standard Marxist idea as well. So it's interesting, you know, he just says like certain things like in American slavery, you can only trend downwards. Like, there's no way for a slave to move up in society. Like, if a free person and a slave have a child, that child is a slave, and that child's children are slaves, etc. If in the Islamic society, there is a multitude of ways for someone to be freed. He actually uses the example, and these are not based just on theory. These are like from court cases and actual realities that were happening, that someone was mistaken for a slave, like, or for a free person. They were a slave. Someone mistook them for a free person, and that granted their freedom. Just that someone addressed them as a free person.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And, you know, you could own property. You essentially had all the rights that a free person would have. It was almost more similar to like a kind of like a wage contract, you know, like a labor contract that you would have today, with some clear differences. You know, it's not exactly the same, but more akin to that in the sense of like, you wouldn't think of it as something that would just like, you know, just reduces you to like this animal kind of, you know, horrible existence or whatever. And he also pointed out that a lot of the major scholars that came about in the second or third generation after like the original early community were the children of slaves. There was a saying that like, what's the word? The maula, which is like the not exactly the slave, but like the owned, the you know, something like that, like the bondsman or whatever, that they have become the keepers of knowledge, that it went from the Arabs to the maula. And maula was a term that was used for non-Arabs as well, like in a general sense, but like there it was very clearly referring to these children of slaves, because if you look at it, that's the case. A lot of the major scholars were directly sons of slaves or freed slaves. So anyway, I don't know exactly why I brought that up. It just was something that has been on my mind, and I guess it's sort of related. Yeah,
it is actually. I was about to say that Mary Tan actually talks about slavery. He brings it up a few times, and it's interesting that he does that, because for the same reason, especially when he's, you know, a lot of the arguments against fascism were calling it like a slave society and things, right? So for him to bring that up in a charitable way is actually pretty bold of him to do. But he refers to it at a few points where he says that Christians lived in, like, say, ancient Rome and things, right, where the Christians have lived in slave societies before, basically, right?
Yeah.
And in those slave societies, it was not the, at least like at the theological level and all that, it was not necessary to rebel against your slave master at every point, kind of thing, right? Like, it's not like the sort of the contemporary American idea of slavery is that it's so noxious that you have to get rid of it, the condition, right?
Yeah.
At any point. Like, that's just your immediate response to the situation is to have to overthrow it, right? So, I mean, in sort of ideological terms, there is that in analogous to dictatorship. People say that at least, right? They say you have to overthrow and create democracy. You know, if you, but Mary Tan actually says that it's interesting because what he says is that, you know, because of render under Caesar, what is Caesar's and all that kind of thing, that Catholics can sort of go along, or Christians, whatever, can kind of go along with society as it is and try to improve it. And they don't necessarily have to be the ones, like, you know, they you can be a Christian and a slave, basically, right? You could be Christian and I don't think he goes into this, but basically the idea that slave society is compatible with being a Christian in some ways, right? Like it's possible. And because it's sort of like this low muck of the way things are organized in society, which is not a direct correspondence with the high values of religion. So his emphasis is on really capacity, and he calls it, like, he uses the word impulse a lot and inspiration. And you can tell that, like, he's very, very interested in the way that things are going overall, and like the people as like this movement that comes up with ideas and then pushes them far. And then he's saying that those kind of things are basically to some extent divinely inspired a lot, and you can't really it's not like a rational thing where you can sit down ahead of time and say, you know, like, you can't look back at the past and say slavery shouldn't have existed then or something like that as much, because the issue is whether or not there was the capacity for the, you know, fraternal bonds of democracy that had been built over time or whatever, right? So I think that's interesting, because it's like, it's a very similar idea, I guess, in that way, is that it allows you to, it rehabilitates the concept in a very narrow way, kind of thing, that it accepts it as something that has, because I think that's something that happens a lot with kingship and monarchy, right? Where people, it's like, you do have this idea that retroactively that you look at history and you say, you know, it's almost like dictatorships all the way down until the 1800s, 1900s or something, right? Like, and that's not necessarily a helpful way to look at the way societies were operated, because they didn't think of it that way. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's almost exactly the same argument, I think, that Brown is sort of making up around slavery. And, you know, it's also that we don't need to, like, reinstate slavery if there was some, like, resurgence of Islamic politics or something. Like, you don't need to go like the ISIS route. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There were countless historical examples of Muslim rulers just refusing to take slaves. Like, the only way you could actually create a new slave, so you have to acquire them in battle. You can't enslave Muslims, and you can't enslave anyone, Muslim or non-Muslim, within a Muslim controlled area, so like inside a Muslim state. So it had to be in a war situation outside of Muslim lands. You take them captive, and then they are slaves, and then they have a certain legal status. And it doesn't mean like you immediately send them to the plantations or whatever. It's not that kind of situation.
Yeah.
Although, you know, that did exist. There were things like that. There were it's interesting, like, this sort of prohibition against taking Muslims as slaves. What happened was there was a sect that essentially did the takfir thing on all other Muslims and said, like, well, you're all non-Muslims because you're doing things wrong, so therefore we can enslave you, and therefore we can set up. So I don't know. It's interesting. I think it's really helpful to look at things from this, like, long view of history, and it seems like you can look at it either from Christian or Muslim or probably other kinds of perspectives like this, where you see, like, the impulse and the really broad view of things can work in any kind of situation, really, and it'll demand different things of you. So one thing that Brown emphasizes is the fact that from the very outset, Islam was obsessed with freeing slaves. It wasn't concerned with the idea of abolition exactly, because that was just like an unthinkable thing. It took centuries for that to be taken seriously. I don't think anyone was really even talking about it. It was like the idea of, like, abolishing work. It's like, okay, well, would be nice, but, you know, how exactly do you propose that happens, you know?
Sure.
So, but the idea of like freeing slaves is a very real possibility that you can have. So it's easy to sort of jump to these criticisms of, you know, these longstanding religions and cultures and stuff and say like, oh, well, you have XYZ thing that I disagree with and I find repulsive or whatever. And, you know, you're not wrong to find them repulsive. And it's definitely not a good idea to like try to bring them back because they like represent like some true manifestation of those religious ideas.
Yeah.
But you also sort of have to accept that there was very positive movement within that culture to deal with these evils. And I think looking at something like, you know, moving forward to like modern day, you look at stuff like capitalism and, you know, exploitation of labor under capitalism. You look at climate change, all that kind of stuff, total war, you know, modern warfare and all that kind of stuff. I don't know that we're dealing with that very well with the concepts, like the ideological tools that we have readily at hand. So if we're going to be critical of pre-modern ideas and stuff because of them not quickly resolving all the issues that they had, well, why aren't we able to do that with our tools that are supposed to, you know, supposedly we've distilled everything down to these like perfect universal truths or whatever. And I just don't buy that. And I don't think it makes sense in the abstract. And I don't think it plays out in reality either. So, I don't know. That's just, I find myself sympathetic to what Maritain is saying. Basically, that's what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of excited by just the idea that this is one of the first things that I've read that sort of explicitly tries to join together religious concepts with political concepts in a way that is more careful, or at least it doesn't lean too far in one direction, basically, I would say. Like, it's not just, you know, here's a history of how the Catholic Church did things. And it's not, here's a reason why, you know, it didn't feel clumsy, I guess it was what I would say. So anyways, that kind of excited me to continue to read on sort of in different post-war Catholic political traditions and stuff. So yeah, I'm going to do that. So I thought it was good to maybe do a book that is fresh in my mind compared to, you know, we had talked about how some of them kind of we were looking backwards a lot, but now trying to work through some of the ones that I've read recently, and I don't know. So yeah, fun.
Yeah, cool. Let's jump into the questions now.
Sure.
Okay. All right. How have you guys dealt with the more extreme or misguided adherence of your respective religions? For instance, I know Catholics deal with groups like the Church Militant or Vortex group, and Muslims deal with the insane people who insist Malaysian food is better than Mediterranean cuisine. Well, Asian food is pretty good, to be honest. I haven't had it very often, but when I have, I've liked it. Not better than Mediterranean, though, that's for sure.
Yeah. So the Vortex, I mean, I think what he means is this: there's this like YouTube show or something. I don't know if it actually is played on any of the Catholic channels, but it's like a YouTube kind of thing where it's this guy that I think he's wearing like a wig or something. He looks like really, really ripped or something. Like he looks like he's like all strong, but he looks like he's like 55 or 60 years old or something. And it's like, he's got like a blonde wig and all of his stuff is about like, he looks gay. That's the thing, is that he looks gay. And then his whole thing is about like the death of masculinity or something, right? Like just all these kind of things, like all these, things. And
his hair looks like that one dentist with the fucked up hair, like, you know, the meme. You know what I'm talking about?
I think I know what you mean. Yeah. But yeah. And it's one of those things where, you know, if someone is outside of your sort of like peer group, you kind of look at them for like 2 seconds and you just kind of you're like, oh, that's why that's their whole thing kind of thing, right? Like you feel like you can kind of like cut them down and go, okay, that's their whole thing. And I feel like we got to be careful about that sometimes, though, because number one, you can learn from people no matter how wacky they are or whatever, right? It doesn't, you know, some people at least, you know, or at least you got to be careful about lumping people together that might not really fit together and all that kind of thing, because I don't know, like, I mean, that's what I did in the past myself with religion kind of stuff. I just, to me, you know, as I said before, that like being a member of like a mainline Protestant church or whatever, just like a normal sort of WASPy kind of thing, was the equivalent in my mind of being a Scientologist or something, right? Like just, it was just total wackiness to do that. I think that's, yeah, you have to, I don't know. I think it's like, what's the bias it's called? I don't know, but, reinforcement bias or something.
Oh, confirmation bias.
Confirmation bias. Yeah. Where you just see a lot of things that, group together in your mind because you associate them with a particular viewpoint. I know this a lot for people that I know that make fun of Catholicism a lot because they group all of these different groups together. And I think people do that. I think that's basically almost how any ideology works anyways, because,
yeah,
you know, the alt-right people have an endless supply of just wacky left-wing people to go through, right? Like, it's not like there's a shortage of people who are like just totally psycho who are left-wing. And you also have that in the same way with, it's kind of like people expect, like, say if you're socialist and you have this, you know, any socialist, no matter who they are, has to look at the world and say that it's failed in a lot of different instances of things that were called that or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Like it doesn't, even if you are, you know, even if you're like a pro-Soviet kind of person or something, you'd have to say, well, Tony Blair is not real socialism or something like that, right? Like you have to look at the world and say,
yeah,
there's something where you have to, you know, so you want people to be charitable to you. So I think that that's part of it too, for like, the opposite, not for people like Vortex maybe as much, but like, it's very, very easy to be charitable towards yourself and critical towards others. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's not even about you want other people to be charitable to you. It's more that you should be able to see how someone could do that with you and the people that you are sort of like could be grouped together with. So be careful that you don't do that with other people, because you might just be wrong. Like, that's a clear error.
Exactly.
It's not even about like manners or whatever, or like being respectful or something. It's just like a making an error. I mean, that confirmation bias is exactly the problem there, I guess, that you have some sort of pre-existing idea and you find what you think is evidence of it when it's in reality it's not that at all, and now you've just reinforced an idea that could be fundamentally wrong, but it's definitely wrong in that particular instance. So like on an interpersonal level, though, but you know, the question's asking about how do we deal with people like that.
Okay, yeah.
I think you just avoid those issues that you have like a difference over if you know that it's not going to lead anywhere productive. Like, what's the point
of
arguing with someone about something?
Yeah.
You know, there's like hadiths about that I could even go to. Like, if someone is trying, like actively, they're just pushing the issue, they really want to debate about something, you know, I can just quote like, you know, argumentation is not from the religion. That's a hadith. I can just go to that. Yeah. And then I kind of exempt myself from, you know, you can't argue with that, right? Like, that's from the prophet. So like, what are you going to do? There's all kinds of stuff like that. I find that people, if they're really into their particular sect, they don't really want to deal with you if you're not part of it anyways. And if they're trying to have an argument, like, it's, you know, if I want to get into it, I'll get into it. I usually don't these days.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just easy enough to avoid the people who you can't really talk to. And then there's people who I might think of their approach to something as being kind of extreme or kind of out there or whatever. But if they're like otherwise a nice person, then it really doesn't even become an issue. It's just like, you know, you meet people of all kinds of different backgrounds and ideas and stuff, and you just don't need to, if they're just an easy to get along with person otherwise, like, why does it have to even go there? You know, you just get along with them the way you might get along with them. It's not that big a deal.
Yeah. And there's different ways to look at things, the similarity of things or like the internal logic of things without necessarily pushing them up against each other to make them clash. Like, even just what, I mean, we just did that for the past hour in some respects where, you know, I'm talking about Christian democracy and stuff, and it's not necessarily going to jive with some like Sharia inspired alternative or something. Right. So, you know,
but there is a lot of compatibility too that we were able to locate. So like, it's not, difference doesn't need to mean conflict. It can,
yeah,
it can almost mean like, oh, look at how we're both similar in this way. That will allow us to get closer to what we're trying to get to, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Been thinking recently about how we have an extreme right-wing government while media has grown more and more left-wing, or at least woke. Historically, is this unusual or common? So I suppose this is an American. I imagine that there's not a Canadian thinking of Trudeau as like an extreme right-wing government. Although I also think calling like Trump's government an extreme right-wing government is, I mean, compared to what? You know what I mean? Like, it's not extreme right-wing compared to like Hitler and Mussolini and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, like, I think the point is a fair point that the media has grown more and more left-wing, or at least woke. And is this unusual or common? I'm not really sure. I haven't looked into that. Do you have any ideas about that, historically speaking?
Yeah, I guess that would be pretty similar. Like, I think that would be common in places where you would see any sort of polarization in society. You're going to see aspects of the culture, you know, being, I think, to be honest, I think to some extent that's being defined that way, because if the, you know, if the media and everything were, you know, right wing, then I don't even know if we would notice it as being, it's hard to, I mean, this is kind of a mind bending thing. I don't know, but like, it's we're thinking that Trump is far right in relation to the segments of society that know it could be better or different or something. Right.
So, yeah.
And because I think that Trump is pretty standard fare for conservatives as like a, you know, like as a populist sort of whatever, but like just a conservative. I mean, even not even just populist in general, but like, I think both of us suffered through Bush pretty, you know, like we knew that things were pretty bad then too. Like, it's not like, and I'm sure Reagan was a very clear example to people at the time. Things like Trump doesn't even really have the analog of like the Central American wars or something. Right. So,
right. Or the Iraq war.
Yeah. And so I don't really buy that idea that it's that different. And I mean, the woke kind of stuff, it's been there for a long time too, but just in different ways. Like, you know, like I think part of it was that the underground scenes and stuff, I think there was maybe more of a public face where they were expected to be prim and proper, but that didn't mean that everyone in society didn't know about scandals in Hollywood and all these different things. And, you know, they knew about different subcultures in their city, like gay subcultures and stuff, right? Like, for decades. And so I don't know. I feel like the fact that it's championed by more mainstream people now is important, but it's not necessarily all that different really from how people experienced it for decades and decades. So yeah,
to me, a lot of that stuff has more to do with the like the internet and the way the internet has become such a dominant social force. Like, if you look at the 90s or whatever, everything was cable TV, Blockbuster movies, stuff like that. Video games was not really such a big thing, although I don't even know if that is like a big social force nowadays either, really. But the entertainment and the kind of cultural messages or whatever that were being produced were necessarily had to fit a very broad idea of an audience, right? And that nowadays you don't need that. And I'm not really sure why things have landed on these particular kind of like woke points of view with these corporations, like why that, not something else. But it seems to have something to do with the way that things play out in social media and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think there's some kind of connection between there's that PMC class or whatever. Like, I don't know if that's the right word here, but there's definitely like this particular kind of class of people who have that kind of like ultra liberal ideology or the woke ideology or whatever. And they are dominant within like the media and stuff like that. And, you know, college campuses and all, you know, I don't know. There's something going on there where there's like a certain section of the population that is close to the production of media and the way that people interact with media. And then that seems to filter into the corporations and then down to like the broader public. Because it doesn't seem like wokeness is like a big cultural force exactly, like at large, like the average person you talk to, they might be aware that there's like something going on, you know, like Caitlyn Jenner or whatever. They might like be like, well, that's something new or something, but I don't think it's like that everyone's like aware of like all the various issues that we see on Twitter and social media like that.
Sure.
Okay, so this question I thought was pretty funny. It's actually two questions. So, Don, have you moved to the right under the influence of Tom? And Tom, have you moved to the left under the influence of Don? So I don't know. I found this funny for a lot of reasons. The first was that I was thinking of us as like Hannity and Combs, like
you know,
that classic Fox Nation.
yeah,
but I also I don't know. I don't think of myself as like right wing at all. But I can kind of see why someone would put me to the right of you, I guess.
Yeah,
because you're kind of very much inside of like a socialist sort of thing, and I don't know. I just am not really in that anymore. So I don't know. What do you think? Have I had some sort of like rightward push on you in some way?
So I think you've contributed to me taking religion more seriously in general, kind of thing. I think that's helped.
That's cool.
And then because of that, along with people online and stuff, I'm more sympathetic, not even sympathetic, but maybe empathetic is the word, like towards a lot of the social conservative arguments that I don't necessarily agree with them, but I do think that they, a lot of them have more merit than, as a potential viewpoint kind of thing than I used to think. So I think that in the sense that that has opened me up to being, you know, like I find it a lot of stuff, when a lot of the flippancy of the left towards the right, I find annoying now. And that is a big change, really, because I had a lot of fun for years being as flippant as possible to right-wing people. So, I don't know. That's a surprise to me. I don't think that I would say that, like, I don't think I would become right-wing ever, but, like, I have that, you know, at least openness to possibly being wrong about a few things here and there. So,
yeah, I think I've experienced the same thing with religion sort of opening me up to be more considerate of right-wing arguments or like social conservative is the better term for it, because it's not exactly right-wing in the sense of like an authoritarian state and right-wing economics and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm very much against that. I think the left critiques about those things are just sound, and I could end up being wrong. I don't know. Maybe I'll change my mind at some point, but I really don't think so. It seems pretty solid to me.
Yeah.
But in a lot of ways, like I've found myself to be more, because I'm not thinking things out through a left wing lens as much. I'm thinking things out more through like Islam. When Islam has a certain position, you know, I'm going to try to cohere to that as much as possible. I haven't found as much difficulty with that these days as I did like in the very early stages. And when there's some kind of conflict, I'm pretty happy to just be like, I don't feel a need to be like, you know, quote, a good leftist or whatever. I find it really funny. Yeah. Sometimes people will criticize and say like, oh, you're not a good leftist. He's a bad leftist or whatever. I was like, well, I'm not trying to be that. So I feel comfortable now just being like, well, that's my religion and that's what I'm going with, and I don't really care to change it to fit like the left wing orthodoxy or whatever.
Sure.
I think, you know, to answer the other question, have I had some kind of left, have you had an influence on me to push me left? I don't think that, you know, because we sort of started out very far on the left.
Yeah.
And so I don't think you've pushed me more in that direction, because I, if anything, I'm like steadily creep towards the center or something like that. But I think you kind of keep me engaged with the discourse on the left that I might not be as interested in otherwise. Because there's just so much silliness, you know?
Yeah, it has
nothing to do with leftism exactly. It's just there's always silliness everywhere. It's the same on like the Muslim social media circles, you know? But yeah, you're definitely someone that I pay attention to, like what you're saying and thinking and reading and stuff like that. That is like, okay, yeah, I'm still sort of, there's something going on that I want to pay attention to going on over there. So,
Cool.
How much would it take to get you guys to sell out? $150, vote Bloomberg 2020. I mean, what am I selling out? I got just whatever. Give me $20. I'll do whatever. I don't know what I'm even got to like hold back on.
Sure.
Okay. I think this one is from our good friends in Brazil. I'm going to try this. This is in Portuguese. Es um membro de uma sociedade secreta satanista de milionários. Nos organizamos orgias, banquetes, canebais y sacrificios humanos. ¿Quer participar? So I think what this is saying is you're a member of a secret satanic society of millionaires. We organize orgies, cannibal banquets, and human sacrifices. Do you want to participate?
No, Satan, get behind me. I don't know. I'm not gonna do that. No.
Yeah, no thanks, and speak English.
Yeah, but shout out to get Fiscal fans in Brazil.
Yeah, that's like my favorite thing. And
okay.
I really like that account.
Okay.
All right. To wrap it up here, someone has submitted not so much a question, but it just says, read Siege by James Mason. So that's like a, like it's this like alt-right book about how Western civilization is being invaded by immigrants or Muslims or something like that. I think it's like supposed to be a novel, but it's sort of like, you know, like in the near future, this is going to happen sort of a thing. I do have half a mind to like read that for us to do an episode on it, just to, I don't know. I'm kind of curious exactly what's going on in it, just to see. Like,
yeah.
I don't know, just to see what's going on with that book. It's really funny to me, the whole like Reed Settlers versus Reed Siege thing.
Oh yeah.
You know, they don't seem to be exactly the same type of thing, but it's almost like, you know, we gotta have something, so let's pick this one. So yeah,
it's funny. Yeah, but it's a real problem. I don't know.
Yeah. Too bad about that wall. You saw the wall was getting knocked down by winds and stuff like that.
Oh no. Oh well.
Yeah. Worth a shot.
If Canada built one with the United States, I would honestly be happy. Not even like as a joke happy. I would be happy and I would just find it funny. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like a pretty much open border. You can just kind of cross it from what I understand. Like if you just
walk across, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right, so let's wrap it up here. Thanks for listening, guys. If you want to hear a second episode that is very much similar to the type of episode that you heard today, you can subscribe to our Patreon and you'll get episodes about us discussing books and political ideas and stuff like that. If you want to submit questions, you can go to our Twitter account at YouCan'tWinPod, and there's the Curious Cat pin there, so you can submit questions to us anonymously. And yeah, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks, guys.
You know the sin to be rich, but it's a low down shame to be poor. Sin to be rich, you know the low down shame to be poor.
got a chance to go to heaven. And a poor man got a hard way to go.
Everybody.